the wrong legal standard with respect to inducement, and then resolve the disputed fact as to whether or not there is a substantial non-infringing use. As the 96 patent, the district court wrongly read in a purposive requirement that is not in claim one and looks to products that are not used.
Ms. Maynard, even if you are correct that the district court erroneously read a substantial non-infringing use prong into inducement, why shouldn't we look at whether or not you had proffered any evidence of genuine issue of material fact on the point of direct infringement? Fully briefed and fully argued, that's why we've got the summary judgment briefing below, and the district court may not have decided it in this case, but it did an alternative basis upon which we could affirm. And it is subject to their entire brief for the most part. So I mean, I don't think they're standing here arguing that substantial amount of infringement use is absolutely a problem of inducement and the district court is right. So why shouldn't we go ahead and reach it?
Because there's a dispute of fact on that point, Your Honor. So if you were to reach it, the right result would be a remand to let the jury decide. I mean, they're stepping back a level.
Well, the question is whether circumstantial evidence has been established or not. Because you don't, while you designated witnesses who have testified for infringement, did not submit them, because I understand that their declarations have been in opposition to some federal motion. So we don't have direct evidence of direct infringement. You're relying on circumstantial evidence, right?
Well, 2 points about that, Your Honor. One is a matter of law and one is a matter of fact. This court's case law is clear in Golden Blonde and Lucent, Justice Light 2 cases, that direct infringement can be proved by circumstantial evidence. Indeed, if the court were to hold otherwise, that would be a rule of evidentiary procedure unique to patent law. It doesn't apply in any civil action of which I'm aware. We can hear
we've all recognized there's Molecular, there's Lucent, there's Vitamin, and there's just the universe of the circumstantial evidence cases in the inducement context on direct infringement. And they've recognized it's possible for circumstantial evidence. They split 50-50. You've got Molecular, and Lucent on one side, and Vitamin just on the other. And the question is, where do you fall in that spectrum? I know where you think you fall, but so I don't think that anybody's going to tell you circumstantial evidence can't ever be enough, but you have to show us why it is. You do acknowledge that Judge Dykes pointed out, and you haven't confused, that you did not proffer any actual instances of direct infringement use. You are relying exclusively on circumstantial evidence.
Well, our expert in the testing did infringe and did finalize, which infringement, and did testify in the opening report that it is the normal use to finalize.
Okay, but that's your expert doing it. That's not evidence of infringement because you asked me to do it. But that can't ever constitute the direct infringement that would be a predicate for inducement.
Even so, that expert testimony distinguishes us from Fujitsu, because in Fujitsu, the court pointed out that there was no such expert testimony. So here we have that extra testimony. Also, I think it's relevant to this court, especially since the district court exercised its discretion not to grant summary judgment on this basis. The district court was aware by the time it ruled on the summary judgment motion that we had we offered three witnesses, but he allowed us one witness who was prepared to testify at trial, that he did be
in front. He didn't have any evidence in on summary judgment at this point. You can't say there was evidence of direct infringement when you proffered none in regards to the summary judgment motion. The fact that he came along later and said at trial at a pretrial conference, we would like to have witnesses to show direct infringement, that's all fine and dandy, but it's not part of the summary judgment record on which the case was decided. So you may well have evidence of direct infringement, not in the record for our purposes, as far as I can tell.
But I do think it's relevant, since the district court didn't reach that basis, and we think didn't reach that basis for very good ground. It wasn't that pre-trial conference. Discovery was still open when we proffered those witnesses. And in fact, it's notable that they objected to our witnesses on the ground that, such direct testimony from direct users might be prejudicial under 403 to the jury. And now they're arguing to this court that the lack of such evidence is a basis to affirm on alternative basis not reached by the district court. And that
you say we should proceed on the understanding or view that the district court here kind of was setting aside the issue of direct infringement for an evidentiary
think one can infer, given the state of its record at the time the district court ruled, when it decided not to base its decision on the lack of direct infringement, that the district court believed there was a dispute fact on that point. Yes, Your Honor. But I mean,
the district court didn't say there was a dispute fact on direct infringement, just didn't reach this ground for some judgment.
To be sure, but I think even if one looks only at the record that before the district court on summary judgment, there's ample evidence here from which a reasonable jury could infer that users are finalizing. And finalizing, there's really no dispute that finalizing
is correct. Substantial evidence, though. And we've now been through this, and there's no actual direct infringement evidence, correct, other than circumstantial evidence.
Yes, Your Honor, in the summary judgment record, but the circumstantial evidence under this court's law is enough, and the circumstantial evidence is ample.
Well, sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. Where should we draw the line as to what's sufficient and what isn't sufficient? Because we've been willing to do that in other cases and to say this can't go to the jury. There's not enough circumstantial evidence here. Some of the cases we said there isn't. Where should we draw the line?
Well, as an initial matter, Judge Day, I don't think that when one's drawing that line, wherever it goes, it should turn on whether the evidence someone's proffering is circumstantial versus direct versus any other kind of evidence. But the rules of evidence don't draw any distinction between the weight given various kinds of evidence, as long as you have enough evidence of whatever kind from which a reasonable jury could infer the conclusion that you seek, the finding that you seek. And here we do. Here we have evidence that the standards require the test pattern and the leading in and leading out edge of this on the DVD. That they comply, the accused did comply with the standards. They market themselves as certified to comply with standards, precisely because the purpose of the standards is to allow the meeting to play in multiple recorders. And that's what consumers want when they watch their meetings. They want them to be able to record them. That's the point. Long-term archival storage. Significantly, the defendant encouraged users to finalize, which practices the method. So I mentioned, just for by way of example, on A12850, important, please read on the product text, this must be finalized for playback in DVD links. An instruction manual for recording software sold by a nation at 12807, in order to improve DVD playback and overall compatibility, choose the DVD ROM thing. So they are encouraging this use, and they are discouraging multi-session. So I just don't see how they can seriously contend that a reasonable jury can't, in the face of that evidence and that argument, conclude that the defendant's users are indeed finalized.
And I would assume that you would point to the Biscuit One segment of the accused product as well, because they can't be used without, they all have been finalized.
If any
sale of Biscuit One would be like sale of an accused product.
Anytime a Biscuit is recorded using Biscuit One, you're exactly right. Judge Moore, that is an infringing use.
Now, they, of course, may argue technically that's not correct, but you can say that there, that's a question of fact.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And that's what distinguishes this case from, so wherever the line is, Judge Dyke, back to your question, wherever the line is, this line has to be, the evidence here has to be enough to get to the jury. I mean, they can make their arguments. They can make their arguments that no user never finalizes. They actually don't argue that to this court, even in the context of their substantial non-infringing use.
So do you want us to reach this issue, or just vacate and remand on the error of law and let the district court re-decide in the first instance direct infringement?
Well, we believe...
You want to reach it and recommend your favor and out of the gun, right? Should we reach it, or should we send it back and say, you messed up by substantial non-infringing use, you have a problem with inducement, go back to the drawing board, look at all the other grounds that they are.
Well, as Your Honor knows, we moved for summary judgment on partial direct infringement.
But we didn't appeal.
I believe that the right answer, if the court is going to reach the question, would be to say there's a dispute of fact for a trial. As you say, that question didn't believe reach this court. But what I don't think this court should do is hold that as a matter of law, no reasonable jury could conclude on this record that the user here never infringed.
Let's turn to 966 before we run out. There's all this language in the specification, including the abstract, about having a number of side identifiers as part of the management. So
claimed by claim one, just that. And claim one is the claim that issues. That's the ability to identify which side, the ability to identify that there's more than one side, and which side is being reported, is the subject of dependent claims three and five. And that is the strongest reason why what the district court did here is error. The language of claim one, the plain language, is satisfied by the issue disk. All that the language, the relevant language in claim one requires is that the information represents the number of reporting claims of the reporting medium. And here there's no dispute that B5 and B6 on the accused disk accurately identify that there is one reporting on the medium.
Why don't claims 3 and 4 actually support the other interpretation? But 3 is saying, for example, that there's not a multi-layer situation, it deals with a situation in which the only reporting claims are two different sides of the data.
What the district court read in claims. In claim one, is that identify which side of the
disk? Well, among other things, it would also have to identify layers and the different layers, right?
Well, here it does identify that they're
active. Well, I mean, that's what the district court's instruction is. It has to identify recording claims that could be different layers or could be different sides, correct?
Well, in his summary judgment ruling, what the district court said is that the purpose of the patent was to identify the size and found summary judgment against Toshiba because the accused product didn't purport to do that.
No, but forget about the purpose language, which I think is sort of perhaps just extraneous here. What does it have to do? It has, in the district court's view, it has to identify multi-layers or multi-layer intent. Also, it has to identify size, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. But it has to identify multi-layer.
What has to identify size? What did you just agree to?
I'm sorry, I thought I was reading about the district court's
characterization.
And I disagree with that characterization. I think all that claim one requires is that it identifies the number of recording claims. And on a single layer, single sided disk, just like that's all there is. And so here it does identify the accused disk. One just focuses on the accused disk, which we think is the right inquiry. They satisfy the limitations of claim one. And nothing about the language of claim one requires you to say, I am the layer, and there's only one layer. It just says that it represents the number of recording claims of the recording medium. And here, this B5 and B6 accurately represent the recording claims of the recording medium. There's one claim, and it says there's one claim.
So in a single sided disk, there's no reason you need an identifier or a variable that says there's only one size. There's only one size.
It accurately says there's only one size. That's correct.
So if there are no layers, and there are only the recording claims are only on either side of the disk, then it doesn't have to have layer identifiers either.
Well, the recording claim could be either layer or size. Yes, just that. So if it were a dual layer disk, either on one side or on multiple sides, then you would need more.
So you're reading the abstract as saying you only need to have a number of sides identifier if you have more than one side.
That's right. If I may.
What kind of difference between between layers and planes? Are they the same?
A plane could be a layer or it could be a size. The plane is broader than the layer. The recording plane. So there are some disks that have two layers. That would be two recording planes, but
on
those
one side.
On one side.
Yes.
And there's nothing on the other side.
Right.
And there are disks with two planes, but one on one side and one on the other side.
Okay, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you. bottom of that page, there's a paragraph that starts, defendant challenges plaintiff's principal theory of liability in several respects, arguing that plaintiff has not established any underlying instances of direct infringement, and then continues on. In the next paragraph, on the next page, 827, Judge Crocker says, both theories of indirect infringement, that is, contributory inducement, fail if there's any substantial non-infringing use in these types of Dynacor. Dynacor is a case where the court found there was no evidence of direct infringement. Dynacor, ACCO, and Fujitsu are three cases where this court has found no evidence of direct infringement. That's what we argued below, as the court has already mentioned in the briefs, and that's what Judge Crocker decided here.
Well, it really doesn't make much difference what he decided, because this is an overall review, and you know, whether he decided this issue or not, the judgment could be confirmed on the ground that there's no evidence of direct infringement.
Thank you.
My question, you know, as we were discussing the standard, is that circumstantial evidence is sufficient sometimes. So why is it sufficient in this case to raise the issue about direct infringement?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly the next point I want to get to. This court, in several opinions, has drawn the line as to when circumstantial evidence is enough and when it's not enough. And I point to three cases. Dynacor, Apple, and Fujitsu are three cases where the evidence was there's an infringing use and a non-infringing use. In those cases, this court said that there is not enough circumstantial evidence to establish instances of direct infringement. So that's one side of the bar. We are like that because we have here a non-infringing use, if you don't finalize, and allegedly an infringing use, if you do finalize. We had other non-infringement defenses that the court didn't address a lot. So we are like ACCO, Dynacor, and Fujitsu. Now, on the other side, I point to
the just so I understand, the other non-infringement defense raised this class of summary judgment.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And I also think there was one or two others that we didn't think were strong when we were stating for trial. Now, on the other side of the line is I4I Lucent. In I4I, direct infringement was stipulated to. In the opinion, it says that there's a stipulation. Microsoft provided an interrogatory response to meaning that users had actually directly infringed. So that's why that's on the other side of the line for direct infringement. So I think Lucent is really the critical case that seems to be drawing the dividing line. And in the Lucent case, this court was fairly clear that this really is the line. At one point, the court said, and this was on jump site page 1318, that the circumstantial evidence in this case, quote, was just barely sufficient to permit the jury to find direct infringement. So you're just barely on the other side of the line. Later in the opinion, I think it's the next page, they said there was just, quote, more than a mere scintilla of evidence. So in that case, I4I just barely got over the bar. And so that's the case that I think sets the dividing line. We are on the other side, and we are significantly different in that case for four reasons.
Your problem is that you have to give us a standard here, which requires to be capable of finalization. You have instructions that suggest that people should finalize it if they don't understand. You have reason to finalize a subject reserved. Why? As a matter of common sense, forget about the case. As a matter of common sense, why is this sufficient evidence that goes to the jury as to whether some of the people buy these bids and why are their intentions?
Your Honor, a number of reasons. First of all, we turn back to Fujitsu and Dynacor, for example. There were industry standards in those cases. And you could say that somebody could practice the industry standard and ultimately could possibly infringe. And yet, in those situations, because there was a non-infringing use and an infringing use, the court found the circumstantial evidence to be not sufficient to establish an instance of direct infringement.
Well, is that really what happened quite clearly in Fujitsu? I seem to remember that case a little bit differently.
Your Honor, in Fujitsu, Fujitsu actually draws another distinction,
yeah,
which is important.
Was it turned off and disabled when told that people were instructed not to use it? Is that right?
Well, I only know what was written in the opinion, but in the opinion, there was one situation where they found direct infringement. And that was a situation where there were customer service records that showed when Netgear sports there advised customers to activate fragmentation. In those instances, there was direct infringement. It was customer service records. Other than that, though, the court found, we agree with the district court that Phillips failed to establish a genuine issue of material fact regarding direct infringement. It is not enough to simply show that the product is capable of infringement. The patent owner must show evidence of specific instances of direct infringement. And then the court said, with the exception of customer service records, Phillips' evidence shows only that the accused product is capable of infringement. That's our case here. There's two different ways you could use it. Potentially, one way is clearly not infringed. There's no dispute if you don't find it. So now another part of this is the question you raised, which is the standards. The standards don't require finalization. If they required finalization, something would happen automatically. Nothing would happen automatically.
Standards require capability.
From the recorder, not from the disk. And that's one of the actually interesting ironies. This is a test having been written by the recorders for use from the recorders, which is very different than the cases here. In IBM and Lucent, Microsoft actually designed software that was found not to have any substantial non-infringing uses. Here, we haven't designed the machines. We made a disk. This case is like the VHS tape. You have a VHS tape, you pop it in your VCR. You want to record a TV series. You may want to record episode after episode and episode, and you never have any intent to ever use that tape on anyone else's machine. Now, sometimes you might give it to a friend and get used on another machine. So here in this case, every end user has the option and makes the decision whether or not they want to use it on any other machine.
How many of these disks are sold every year?
Quite a few.
Yeah, it's sort of hard to imagine that there's somebody out there.
But that's
who's motivated to use the finalization capability and to preserve the disk.
Your Honor, with all due respect, if you want to play the numbers game and try to determine probabilities, then there's no explanation for Jitsu, Apto, and DynaCorp. There was a substantial number of products in those cases. This court has shown.
But in Fujitsu, as I'm reading from it, the standard didn't require fragmentation. Fragmentation was optional. And it was disabled. You had to actually affirmatively go in and turn it on in order to use it. And that's right here in the opinion. So, I mean, that does kind of paint a different picture. We're selling something that has a capability that is, in fact, entirely disabled, a capability which is not required by the standard. That's a really different situation.
Your Honor, in this situation, you have to choose finalization. And we pointed to the Fujitsu. I'm sorry.
Their argument is that it's automatically finalized. Now, I understand you may dispute that from a technical standpoint, but that's a question of fact.
Your Honor, to use the disk at once, you have to select it. And so there's an option in the Nero software which you have to select to use disk at once. And we cited the Toshiba manual. Toshiba actually makes these recorders. We cited the Toshiba manual. We cited the page that shows five steps the customer has to take to finalize. It's clearly an optional choice by the customer. It doesn't happen automatically. There's nothing in the standard that makes it happen automatically. The standard required by the standard simply gives it true. If the standard wanted it to happen automatically, something would happen automatically. If it required it, something would happen. The user has to select finalization, has to go through the Toshiba manual, has to go through five separate steps. And I can cite you on to that page.
Yeah, but you're almost returning to the necessarily infringes argument, and Lucent makes it clear that that's not required.
Your Honor, that was the theory they argued below. That was the only theory they argued below. Your Honor, I don't think that's correct. We have cited to this court their interrogatory response. We cited to this court our proposed findings of fact, where they said they didn't dispute it, and it's in Judge Crocker's opinion also. That was the only theory, because, as Your Honor said, that had no evidence of any specific instances of direct infringement. And more so, what they wanted was they wanted damages for every single disc sold. They had a choice. If they want to go specific instances of direct infringement, they would only be able to seek damages on those specific instances. What they wanted was damages on every single disk. That's what their brief says, that's what their damages expert report says. They continue to say that all disks infringe. They made a tactical choice. They're not happy with that choice, and so now here, they essentially want to do over.
Can we turn to the 966?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did the district court read a purposeful requirement in?
Your Honor, the district court used the word purpose to distinguish clearly from their proposed construction, which was capable of. They wanted it to say capable of identifying the total number of layers in the specific layer. Capable of would mean sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong. It's like a broken clock. So the court used purpose to distinguish from capable of. Now, purpose, this court has accepted as being correct in the Ingray Katz case, and specifically used the word purpose in the claim construction. Purpose also appears in the prosecution history, where in the prosecution history,
but that's not really the issue. I mean, the question is, does this have to be able to identify both the layers and the sides, or doesn't
it? That's exactly what that means. And as I said, the court used purpose to really distinguish from the possibility of capable of. We presented to the court.
Okay, well, we can make our own claim construction. We don't need to worry about that. And here, the basic contention is that they have to be able to identify sides of the layer. The question is that right here or is that not right?
Your Honor, that is correct, because what this patent was about was identifying the total number of layers on a recording medium and then the specific layer being recorded. Now, in the patent, the example used was one layer on one side, one layer on the other side. And so the discussion in the specification was about being able to identify side A or side B, because necessarily if you had side A or side B, you would know which layer you're referring to. That's just an example. That's the dependent claim. The independent claim is broader. The independent claim is referring generically to the total number of layers on a medium and the specific layer being recorded. It has to be right. It has to be right all the time. There's no dispute that the B5, B6, and B24 are for a standard that covers both a single-sided disk and a double-sided disk. And there's no dispute that those bits identify the number of layers on one side and not on the other side.
But if it is a single-sided disk, they are identifying all the layers on each side.
Coincidentally, in that...
But this is an apparatus claim. So who cares if they're doing it by coincidence if they're actually meeting the limitation of the apparatus claim?
I don't think they're meeting the limitation because the claim requires accurate information about the disk as a whole.
About those single-sided disks, is it not ever inaccurate?
Only because
about single-sided disks, is that is B5 and B6 and B24 ever inaccurate in recording the number of layers in the recording medium?
Your Honor, in that case, it's coincidentally correct.
That's a yes or no question. Is it ever, are they ever inaccurate?
I don't know.
How can you say that? You've admitted in your briefing that B5, B6, and B24 do report the number of recording layers.
For that, so
I don't see why they didn't make summary judgment in favor on this.
Well, Your Honor, because, number one, one other thing, let me mention, because I mentioned a few things already. In the prosecution history, there was a Radacci reference. In that case, there were only two sides. In every instance, there was two sides because it was taped.
But they're not accusing. They have chosen to forego accusing all two-sided disks of infringement, recognizing that in a two-sided disk, there wouldn't be infringement. They have accused all, I mean, that's a large segment of the market. So they haven't accused those of infringement. They've accused only the ones that fit the claim limitation.
Your Honor, that's a dependent claim. The dependent claim is directed to picking the size of the disk. Independent
right.
Claim
so
is
why should the independent claim be limited to requiring an identification of the number of sides?
Because it's not really identification information. And sometimes it's right.
I say that the specification says so. It says you've got to have a number of sides identified. I thought you were saying the specification says so because it says that you've got to have a number of sides identifier.
Yes, Your Honor.
Suggests that you've got to be able to identify.
that's right.
Can you tell me where the specification that is the requirement that should be read into every claim, even when a claim doesn't contain a limitation and independent claims do? How often do we take a line in the abstract and import it into a claim? Can you give me a single case that we've done that?
Your Honor, the patent itself, I'll be getting a copy. The patent itself is describing as a mechanical, and it has shown in an operating. Your Honor, we showed the example in our brief. It's in figure 2, and the disk side identifier number 3. It's on page 54 of our brief.
I'm sorry, are you pointing me to a portion of the patent?
Yes, it's in figure 2. We have it in our brief on page 54. I found that fast in the comments of that. So if you look at figure 2, figure 2 of the patent, if you look all the way down, you see a number 3 and a number 2. 3 is disk side identifier, and 2 is number of disk side identifiers. And for the number of disk side identifiers, 008 on the right-hand side says that there's one side, and 018 says that there's two sides.
I do not doubt your assertion, and I don't think the standard would, because if there happens to be an embodiment disclosed in the specification that includes an identifier of size, as I understand her argument, is that that limitation is not present in Claim 1. It is present in the dependent, but not present in Claim 1.
Your Honor, this is the support for that limitation claim. The claim is referring to number of disk sides, and
where is the claim referring to number of disk sides? In Claim 3?
I know the term is that with the screwdriver. Number of recording planes identifying information. That is supported by what I just referred to, which provides information as to whether or not there is one side or two sides.
Where in the specification does it define number of recording planes as a necessary requirement to be telling the number of sides?
The only example given in the patent is that.
We have a figure that includes, as one identifier present in this process, a number of disk sides, and I'm supposed to take from its random inclusion in this table that it necessarily is the limiting definition for number of recording planes.
That is the only support, Your Honor. I encourage she will provide other support if there's a different support, but that is the support in the patent. That's the example that's used. And then the claim continues on to say that represents and that uniquely identifies. That means, in plain language, that the identifying information is correct. And in the patent, gives the example of one side or two sides, one layer or two layers. The construction that Toshiba provides would not work in the patent. Because what they want is they want a construction that says if I have two sides, their construction would not work if there's two layers, a layer on both sides.
Okay.
Here.
urge their consumers to finalize, they want to use their discs and other recorders, DVD players, and that they recommend against non-infringing use. That, in whatever, wherever the